ladies and gentlemen. I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival for Wednesday night, the 8th day of November, year of our Lord, 2017. Our guest tonight will be James Corbett from the Corbett Report, and James should be joining us after the first break. Before we get to James, market reports. Gold is up $6 today to $1,281.80 per ounce. Silver's up 8 cents to $17.09 per ounce. Platinum is up $10 to $935. Palladium is up $21, $1,019. Palladium is just strange. I don't know what's happening with palladium. It's not something I think about, follow, invest in, but it has been dynamic for the last month or more, moving up $15-$20 in a day, moving down $15-$20 in a day. It's been pretty spectacular and pretty amazing. In the paper markets, Dow Jones was up 6 points today to 23,563. NASDAQ was up 21 points to 6,789. New York Stock Exchange was up 13 points to 12,385. Standard & Poor's 500 was up almost 4 points to 2,594. And what have we got? Crude oil was up 12 cents. To $56.93 per barrel, and the U.S. dollar index was up 0.04 to 94.90. Dollar index was down, had fallen in the last 2 months, fallen down to where I think it was down in the neighborhood of 91 thereabouts, and we assumed, kind of assumed that it was going to break through 90. We thought it had momentum to do that, but the powers that be apparently have decided the dollar is not going under 90 just yet. So they've boosted it up to $94 and or 94.90 on the U.S. dollar index. And the crude oil has followed. It's down in the low, in the high 40s and is now not $56.93 per barrel. Crude has also made a good recovery in recent weeks. Before we get to James Corbett, let's take a look at, here's an article from DC Clothesline. And the headline in the article is, the Federal Reserve has just given financial markets the greatest sell signal in modern American history. Right, now, what could that be? Well, they say, why have stock prices risen so dramatically since the last financial crisis? There are certainly many factors involved, but the primary factor is the fact that the Federal Reserve has been creating trillions of dollars out of thin air and has been injecting all of that hot money into the financial markets. And there's great truth in that. That's certainly been going on. The extent to which it's happened, are there more significant factors? Probably not. And in other words, they did quantitative easing. They essentially juiced the markets. They have artificially stimulated the markets since 2008 in order to rebuild. After the markets had crashed at the onset of the Great Recession, the Federal Reserve has spent an enormous amount of money, currency at least, not money, but currency. They suppressed interest rates in order to try to stimulate the economy, and although the economy did not respond very well, the stock markets certainly did. A lot of the Fed's money went into the stock markets. A lot of that money boosted it up to current 23,000 range in the Dow Jones. And what they're saying, but now the Federal Reserve is starting to reverse course. And this has got to be the greatest sell signal for financial markets in modern American history. Without the artificial support of the Federal Reserve and other global central banks, there is no possible way that the massive inflated asset prices that we're witnessing in the equities markets can continue. Now, it's their claim there's no way this can continue. That's a broad assertion. I won't say there's no way, but I agree with them. It's unlikely to continue, and it's just common sense. Doesn't take much sense at all. You've heard the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates. Well, they lowered interest rates to nearly zero in order to prevent the economy from sliding into a depression, and it worked. It didn't really stimulate the economy a lot, but it prevented the economy from completely collapsing. Now, they are beginning to raise interest rates again. And it's hard to know how high they're going to raise these interest rates, but insofar as perhaps next month in December they raise interest rates another 0.25%, and a month or two after that they raise it another 0.25%, and they keep on going, and every couple of months they raise another 0.25%, well, if dropping interest rates down to near zero was enough to stimulate the economy, then it has to follow that if you start raising interest rates again, you're going to tend to slow the economy down. The Federal Reserve is arguing that it's okay to raise interest rates because the economy is strong. We've had the recovery. But a lot of people look at it and they think, no, we haven't had a recovery. There are some elements of this country that have had a recovery, but a great deal of the country has not really recovered from the Great Recession. We're still in the doldrums. In fact, we read one article last week, I think, where I don't even remember who, but one of the significant figures on Wall Street, might have been Ray Dalio, maybe, I don't recall clearly, but he argued that there are two parts of the American economy. And for the top 40%, things have gotten better since the Great Recession. And for the top 40%, there has been a recovery. But for the bottom 60%, there has not been a recovery. And he warned that you better keep an eye on that bottom 60% because they're volatile. They're impoverished. They are not doing better. They're in danger because they don't have any savings. If there's a significant dislocation, they're going to be in a lot of trouble, and they will respond to trouble by causing trouble. So the country, parts of us, and I agree with that assessment. Parts of us are doing much better, and you could argue that part of the country has recovered, but most of the country has not. Does anyone out there really believe, the article continues, that immensely bloated balance sheet that the Federal Reserve has accumulated can be unwound without having enormous negative impact on Wall Street? The balance sheet, of course, is where they list the alleged assets that they purchased during the Great Recession. And they purchased something like nearly $4 trillion worth of stocks and bonds. And they did this to shore up, to maintain prices and prevent the markets from collapsing. The instinct of the market was to collapse. The Federal Reserve stepped in and they started buying stocks and they started buying bonds. And they paid full price for them when, if they'd left it alone and they'd allowed the free market to respond freely, the free market would have pushed those prices down dramatically. Well, the Fed was able to buy stocks and bonds, and they put them on their balance sheet, and some of them they called toxic assets. What they meant by that is these things were no longer worth their face value. They were toxic. You could pay $100 for a particular stock, but it was only worth maybe 75 or 80. They called it toxic because it was a fancy name for saying these things are overpriced. Well, the Federal Reserve has these stocks and bonds, almost $4 trillion of them, sitting on their balance sheet. And the Federal Reserve wants to start selling them back into the markets. They want to get the cash. But if they do, where's the cash coming from? It's cash that has been helping to support the Dow Jones, for example. If they minimized the damage caused by the Great Recession by buying stocks and bonds, probably in paying full price for them at when the free market price would have dropped significantly, and artificially holding those prices up, what's going to happen if they start selling those stocks and bonds back into the economy? They can't sell many of them. They're talking about unwinding that, but they're going to sell a small percentage, and it could take, who knows, a decade to dump them, to dump their stocks and bonds. But nevertheless, my point is, insofar as they say we are going to sell stocks and bonds rather than buy stocks and bonds, they are implying that, first off, they believe the economy is strong, which I think is a false assumption. And secondly, they're saying that if stocks and bonds, buying them, supported the economy and helped the economy to seemingly recover, at least in places, then selling those stocks and bonds, those same stocks and bonds today, is going to probably put pressure on the economy and push it toward recession and or depression. So we're caught in a peculiar situation here where, again, the analogy is, it's like squeezing one end of a balloon. All right? Yep, you can squeeze it hard enough where it seems to shrink. But inevitably, there's going to be a bubble, a balloon. It's going to get bigger someplace else at the other end of the balloon. You got a long sausage-shaped balloon, squeeze it at one end, it bulges at the other end. There's no free lunch. You don't get to simply overpay for stocks and bonds in order to maintain the market and hold prices up and even drive them higher when the free market thinks it should go down. You can do that for a while. You can maintain that illusion for a while. And in this case, a decade or more. But inevitably, you have to deal with the truth. One of the truths that they're going to have to deal with is when they go to sell their stocks and bonds on the open market. And they're not going to sell a lot of them all at once. They're going to sell a small quantity. Unless they have rigged the game where J.P. Morgan Chase, for example, or Bank of America, or someone is buying those stocks or bonds from the Federal Reserve and paying full face value, almost certainly what's going to happen if they say, okay, we want to sell these stocks and bonds, how much will you give us? And the free market is going to look at those stocks and bonds that the Federal Reserve paid $100 a piece for, just to pull a number out of the air. They're going to look at it and say, we're not paying $100 for that stuff. You think we're crazy? You overpaid when you bought it. That stuff is only worth $50-$60 a share right now. The Federal Reserve is caught in a situation where they can't sell their stocks and bonds for much less than the full face value that they paid for them back during the Great Recession. If they admit that the stocks and bonds they paid $100 for during the Great Recession is now are only worth $50 a share right now, it means that the $4 trillion that the Fed has on its balance sheet, or roughly $4 trillion, if it means that that $4 trillion is going to be shown to be worth much less than what they claimed. In theory, the numbers may be over, the numbers I'm using may be exaggerated, but if they paid $4 trillion for the stocks and bonds, maybe it's only worth $2 trillion today. I don't think the Federal Reserve can absorb a $2 trillion paper loss. Even though they print money, I don't think that's something they can easily accept or absorb. And it's not just the Federal Reserve. If the Federal Reserve starts auctioning stocks and bonds and the price of those bonds and stocks fell by 50% on the stocks and bonds that are on the Fed's balance sheet, what happens to the value of stocks and bonds that are in the market that make up the Dow Jones or the Standard & Poor's or whatever bond index you want to point to? What happens to them? They are also going to be devalued probably by a percentage comparable to whatever the Fed is able to sell its bonds on the market for. So unless they've cut a deal where J.C. Morgan Chase agrees to pay full face value for the bonds, Federal Reserve selling these stocks, bonds, are probably going to create evidence that they're not worth anywhere near as much as they're being valued as they paid for them. That will affect not only the Federal Reserve, it'll affect the markets. It'll affect stocks and bonds that had nothing to do directly with the Federal Reserve. they are caught in a situation, and even if they manage to cut some secret deal where the Bank of America or J.P. Morgan Chase or some major Wall Street firm, one or more of them, are paying full price for these stocks and bonds, then they're just, it's like playing old maid. Okay, J.C. Morgan Chase, just imagine that there's $4 trillion, and just for the sake of argument, or nearly $4 trillion. Let's suppose J.C. Morgan Chase bought all of that. Well, that's very nice. Thank you very much. But you've just purchased the Queen of Spades. You have just now, you've got $4 trillion worth of stocks and or bonds that are only worth maybe $2 trillion. What's that going to do to J.P. Morgan Chase? Can any major institution afford to buy these bonds at full face value? And even if they can figure a way to wheel and deal and generate more paper currency to create the illusion that the stocks and bonds are worth their face value, sooner or later, if the Federal Reserve isn't forced to face the fact that the stocks and bonds have been devalued, then J.P. Morgan Chase is going to face the fact that the stocks have been devalued. Or maybe they can find another third party beyond J.P. Morgan Chase who can also somehow afford to seemingly purchase these stocks and bonds and pay full face value, even though they're worth a lot less. Now, I've used the example of being worth 50% less, but maybe 20% less, 30% less. It doesn't have to be 50%, at least not initially, but that's where we're headed. And in fact, I've said it a bunch of times over the last 5 years, my guess is that before this is done, the paper assets in this country are going to be devalued by at least 80 and maybe 90%. I'd guarantee they're going to be devalued by 50% because the debt is simply too big. We can't pay the existing debts, and it means we can't pay full price for the stocks and the bonds, the debt instruments. Those people that are hanging on to those pieces of paper are in great, you know, they are in significant danger right now, because sooner or later, we're back to that balloon analogy. You can squeeze the balloon at one end, it bulges at the other end. If you try to suppress the bulge at the second end, it's going to start inflating at the first end. There's no free lunch. What there is, you can postpone the trouble. You can use clever accounting gimmicks and artificial currency and artificial stimulation to postpone the problem, but you cannot escape the problem in the sense of we've cured it, we've solved the problem, and we don't have to worry about it anymore. Someone is going to have to deal with the fact that the stocks and the bonds are overvalued at this point in time. We're going to take a break for a couple of commercials. We'll be right back, and James Corbett should be joining us from Japan. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSCTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hi, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Alfred Addis, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Our guest is James Corbett, calling in from Japan. James is the author, creator of the Corbett Report, one of the better reports on the internet in terms of geopolitics, politics in general, economics, social phenomena. So hello, James, how are you?
Well, I'm doing all right, but the real question is, how is the rest of the world doing? That's what we should all be thinking about today.
Oh, come on, James. That's un-American to think about the rest of the world.
Maybe so.
You've got to look out for number one, James. We don't have to worry about the rest of the world. Get what you can while you can, and that seems to be the attitude for much of the world.
Yes. Well, it does. Yeah.
Has it always been that way to the same degree we see today? You know, take care of number one. Or has there been a time when people actually had a little more concern for their neighbors than we see today?
Well, you would be maybe the better person to ask on that question, as you have a little bit more experience under the belt. But from my own experience...
Oh, that's just a polite way of saying I'm elderly.
I'm saying you're old and wise.
Experience under the belt. Huh?
Wisdom and knowledge. And experience.
Yeah. Bills.
Well, at any
bills,
rate.
Wisdom and knowledge and bills. Unpaid bills that have to be considered.
Well, let's look at that question from an even longer perspective than either you or I have direct experience with. But let's look back. I've talked about this before, but I think it's important to look back at, for example, you know, what was happening 90 years ago or so. You were going through a pretty large economic... you were not.
You mean sorry. America? I was not personally going through that.
But not you personally. The American people were going through, and people around the world were going through, pretty large economic upheaval. And at that time, lots of unemployment, lots of stories about people who were just scraping by. Brother, can you spare a dime? But, on the other hand, there were resilient local communities of people who were willing and able to help each other out and see each other through tough times. Does anyone think that if there was a similar economic depression going on in the United States right now, that would be the overarching spirit of people caught up in that? And I think the answer is no. That might be anecdotal, but...
You know, I think it's a good question, a good observation, and everyone kind of understands that during the Great Depression, people were more rural. There was a higher kind of, there was a higher percentage of people lived in a rural environment than in big city environments. They were at least able to grow, raise, have a garden. They could feed themselves to some degree. They were able to get by. Right now, we are structured in a way where there's maybe 3 days' supply of food in any city in the country. That wasn't true back then. I mean, grocery stores used to be. You had a little outlet in front where we had some stores and cans and butcher shop and the rest of that sort of thing, and a huge warehouse behind the grocery store where they would buy a truckload of beans, Campbell's beans, and they'd store them back there in the warehouse. And when we sold some beans out of that little storefront in front of the warehouse, then they'd go out in the warehouse, get some more beans, put them in here. But they had a massive supply But now we have a just-in-time supply system where we don't need the warehouse behind the grocery store. The groceries are coming in every day, and anyone who goes grocery shopping 10 o'clock at night at your grocery store, you can they're stocking the store, they're stocking the shelves that night. What do you think about that just-in-time supply system? Is that good for us, or is it dangerous?
Well, of course, I think expected to believe that this is all the miracle of modern society and how wonderful everything is. And on the surface, of course it is. I mean, let's do the thought experiment. Is there any other time in history where you would like to live, where you think you would be more comfortable with the creature comforts that you enjoy today? And I think the answer is no. Certainly, the further back in time you go, the more likely you are to be living like a peasant, you know, digging through the dirt and eking out a meager existence. So, yes, I think things have improved in that respect. And yes, you can walk into a supermarket in the middle of the night here and buy anything you want, including produce that was grown halfway around the world and that might be out of season where you are. The miracles of modern society. But as you say, there's an insidious part to all of this, one of which is that it's an extremely delicate supply line, and that if there were massive geopolitical upheavals, those things that we take so much for granted could very quickly disappear. In fact, overnight could disappear. And we see that in times of emergency with people stocking up for hurricane, this or that, but imagine that in a larger warfare scenario and the types of disruptions that can happen there. The other part of this that's, I think, even deeper and even more insidious is the very idea of the entire society that has been created since the Great Depression, presumably, ostensibly, to keep something like that from happening again, or at least to protect people should something like that happen again. The entire infrastructure of the social welfare system, the cradle-to-grave system that's going to protect everyone and swaddle them in the loving arms of the government, has made people very much if not subservient, at least dependent on systems of control that they may not even be really aware of and may not really experience until there is that crisis. And that, I think, is the insidious part of all of this.
One of the things I've observed over the years is that as we become more efficient, we also become more vulnerable. And the example that always comes to my mind I use on a regular basis, this goes back probably 15, 20 years ago, General Motors. They started a just-in-time supply system. It used to be that General Motors and the other manufacturers of automobiles, they had engine blocks, acres and acres of engine blocks and fenders and frames and whatever out in the back, in the back 40 acres. And they had stacks of this stuff. All right, and if the workers went out on strike, they didn't care. They had plenty of stuff to build. We'd get some more employees in here, and we'll build more cars. All right, because we had this massive supply of parts out in the backyard. But over time, someone came up and explained to them, we can do this just-in-time supply system where instead of tying up all of your capital in these parts that are laying out in the backyard, we can set this up where you have new engine blocks coming in the door just as soon as you run out. We're going to bring you a new truckload of engine blocks, and just at the time when you run out of engine blocks on your assembly line, and you'll never have to waste capital tying it up in that inventory out in the backyard, just like the grocery stores had a huge inventory in the warehouse behind the storefront where they sold groceries. You don't have to do that. It's more efficient. You're going to save money. But here's what happened to General Motors. They had all of their brake shoes were coming from a single manufacturer that had something like 40 employees. And those 40 employees went out on strike. And they wouldn't come back to work no matter what. And they were the only ones who could produce the brake shoes that they needed for all of General Motors' products. And they shut General Motors down for something like 6 months. One little kink in the just-in-time supply system, and you are finished. And it doesn't take a it doesn't take a war. It doesn't take a geopolitical change that's massive. It takes one little link in the chain says, ha-ha, we're going out on strike, and guess what? Your whole chain is broken. So my point is that with greater efficiency, we also have greater vulnerability. And there's a danger in that. I'm sure the government recognizes that. And if you see it and you understand what I'm talking about, do you think that this greater vulnerability, does it necessarily make the government more of a police state? Do they have to protect the government from, do they have to protect this just-in-time system? This super efficient system is also super vulnerable, which means if one guy does something crazy, all of a sudden they push the right button and the next thing you know, the whole economy shuts down. Does it mean that we have to have a police state because we have a just-in-time supply system? Do you follow what I'm saying?
I do follow what you're saying, and let's just go on some absurd flight of fancy right now, and just imagine that there are people in positions of power who are in those positions because they want to control and consolidate people and consolidate power on a large scale, and they're looking for any way to actually increase their power over other people. Let's just imagine that were the mm-hmm. case. If that were so, then when it comes to something like this extremely delicate supply chain that the manufacturing base and so many things rely on, when it comes to that, if there is any disruption, then it could create these huge problems. I guess the only question then is the control gained by having that vulnerability there, and thus you have to be the person who's protecting it and in the interest of national security, yeah. or even to maybe let something disrupt that chain so that people feel a bit of pain, so that you can be the one coming with the oil can to, you know, smooth things out and get the gears grinding again. That is the insidious part of all of this. It's that always, no matter whether things go okay or whether things really mess up and everything goes wrong, you still get to be the savior. You get to be the person who's looking after and who is the answer to any problem that comes along if you are in those positions that are entrusted with securing this. So just, you're right, just by the nature of this system, it does create the ostensible need for these people to protect the system, because otherwise everything will fall apart.
It's to me, it's part and parcel of this idea where we're going to monitor everybody's cell phone and perhaps keep track of you every moment of your life and watch what you're producing, and everybody's going to be monitored and you can forget privacy because they can't trust us. And their fears are not necessarily irrational. The question becomes, are they simply in it for more power, or are they actually acting from a benign influence to say, look, we can't let these crazy people just do anything they want or the whole system will blow up? Are they really here to help us, or are they here to rule us?
Well, you know my answer to that, but just to make it explicit, they're here to rule us, and any excuse to do so is a good excuse. So I think, I mean, these things develop because they are efficient and they run well when they run well. But they are also, I think, these ideas are promoted because they do promote the idea that we need centralized power in order to protect and safeguard these systems. I mean, it's a win-win, isn't it, for people who want control?
Yeah, that's right. And it's a question of what are they really doing? Is this a pretext to gain power, or are they genuinely concerned about trying to maintain the system? I don't read it as they have genuine concern about maintaining the system, except insofar as they're in a position to exploit the system, and they can make more money for themselves if the system continues to function. All right, so they have a vested interest in keeping it going. But I don't think that vested interest from their mind has anything to do with the general public. The general public are consumers. We need consumers. I mean, what do you think about, why do we have a consumer-based economy rather than a producer-based economy? And is that good, bad, dangerous? What do you think?
Well, actually, this is it's an even deeper question than I think most people realize, because it goes to the real heart of who we are as human beings, what we do as human beings. Are we consumers or are we producers? Are we passive observers of what is happening around us, people who just get slotted into a system and just go along to get along? Or are we active participants in building the reality we want to build? I mean, that's the ultimate base of this mm-hmm. question. And I think that the idea of consumer culture, and everyone's just a consumer and we're all just here to consume whatever is put in front of us, is a mindset that has been inculcated over the course of generations that creates this dependency on these systems, because fewer and fewer people actually feel like they are participating in the production of anything in this economy. People are more just geared towards consuming. And we are heading more and more in that direction as we've talked about before, as the robotic labor economy comes into view and as ideas like universal basic income and things like that get thrown around, people become even more embedded in this system of dependency on these structures and on these systems and on government itself. And I venture to say, you take someone from a century ago even, let alone a couple of centuries, and put them in modern day 21st century America or anywhere else, and look at the abject state of dependence that so many people are on in so many different facets of their lives, and I think that would be a nightmare to a lot of the people who are the forefathers of the people who are walking around today thinking this is all just par for the course, this is normal, this is how we live our lives.
Well, we are all part consumer and part producer, or at least we should be. The question is, do we produce enough? Do I produce enough to feed myself? Or do I have to rely on someone else to subsidize me, give me welfare, subsidize me if I'm a rich poor, rich guy or whatever, welfare if I'm poor? Can I support myself and maybe even save money beyond what it costs to live, in which case I'm really a producer? Or am I primarily a consumer who maybe produces nothing? Can the society continue with a bunch of people, a significant portion of the people, who are consumers? Can we really, how does this work out if we're not producing more than we're consuming? It's a question of emphasis. I mean, most of us are both, but can we afford the emphasis on consumerism, or is that self-destructive?
Well, just everyone can get jobs in the service sector, and that will be, and I guess a few people might be able to make apps and sell apps, and that will be the new economy, the app and service economy, and everyone will be happy, and what could go wrong with that? I think there may be an excluded part to that equation. What do you think?
I think apps are old news. We don't create apps anymore. We create new cryptocurrencies.
It's true, actually, yeah.
I think maybe we should have... each of us should have our own cryptocurrency. We're already up to, I've heard some reports,
laugh, but
we might
it is
be
going
over
in that
1,000.
Direction.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand that. Do you have a birth certificate? No, I have a cryptocurrency. I have the Alfred Addis cryptocurrency. How many would you like?
How Are you many interested in you buying like? My tokens? Maybe
yes.
The new pickup line.
We definitely live in interesting times, that's for sure. Do you think anyone, we've got maybe 40 seconds left before we take a break, do you think anyone really understands what's happening in the economy right now? Janet Yellen has said she doesn't understand it. There's been another major figure in the Federal Reserve said they don't understand inflation. Does anybody really understand, and is it possible to understand the modern economy?
Not the system that has been created, which is so rigged and manipulated in so many ways. I don't think anyone does ultimately have the handle on the economy, the way that it's been created. So no, I think the short answer is no. It's all a big experiment, and people would, most economists will admit.
Yeah,
that.
And who's the lab rat? Okay. I mean, there is the problem. Experiments are interesting, but who gets to be the lab rats? And I'm afraid it's the taxpayers. We're going to take a break for a couple of commercials, and James and I will be right back on the financial survival. Just a moment, please stay tuned.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival. Our guest is James Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, from thecorbettreport.com. You can find him on the internet, lots of videos, podcasts, written articles, excellent thought, and a focus for intellectuals, and really around the world. James, you've spoken in a number of places. You're living in Japan, but you were in Amsterdam probably about, a month ago?
I was in Denmark a month ago.
Denmark.
2 months ago. I've been in Amsterdam, but that was a couple years ago.
But you're invited to speak, sometimes go there physically, different places around the world. You're invited, you participate in a lot of radio programs and video programs and whatever. You're in Japan. President Trump has visited just lately. Did he come over there to feed the hungry, the starving fish? Do you think he's an animal lover? Is that what we saw with his trip to Japan?
That's what most people are going to remember from this trip, the famous photo of him dumping out the fish food, right? Yeah. Well, that was part of the visit. And apparently another important part of the visit is the fact that he ate an American beef burger with Heinz ketchup instead of, traditional Japanese food. So there you go. That's the big news from Japan. But maybe some other important things happening while he was here as well. Of course, everyone, at the big topic of conversation is North Korea and what are they going to do. But I think perhaps even more important was the story that might have slipped under the headlines about the building, quote-unquote, potentially, of a alternative, to China's Belt and Road Initiative, which we've talked about before, this big trillion-dollar idea of investing all around Eurasia and creating these land and sea routes for trading partners for China, basically all around the world. Well, apparently, they're starting to come up with some sort of potential alternative to that. And we saw a glimpse of that last month with Tillerson giving the State Department's idea of creating an Indo-Pacific nation alternative infrastructure investment program, so putting India kind of in the important driver's seat in the AP region, which would be an interesting turn, and obviously seen as kind of a check, not a checkmate, but at any rate a check against growing Chinese power, and Japan would be an important part of that. So when Trump was here, we did see them talking about, inking some deals. There was a deal between the OPIC, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, which is the U.S. government's development finance agency, and its Japanese counterparts to, quote-unquote, offer high-quality United States-Japan infrastructure investment alternatives in the Indo-Pacific region. We also saw the creation of this Japan-United States Strategic Energy Partnership to promote universal access to affordable and reliable energy in Southeast Asia, South Asia, and Sub-Saharan Africa, and some other deals between the U.S. Trade and Development Agency and the Japanese Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry. So definitely some deals being made and some at least proposals being put on the table right now for ways that Japan and U.S. can work together in this Indo-Pacific idea. Remains, of course, to be seen how much of this will translate into real reality. There's always a lot of highfalutin language when these people get together, and not always such great follow-up. But at any rate, we're starting to see potentially some indication of what Trump might have in mind for an alternative or a check against this Chinese Belt and Road Initiative.
Word is Japan is energy dependent, so far as I understand. They have to import most of their energy. Where do they get, assuming that's correct, where do they get most of their petroleum products?
Well, they are highly dependent on imports of, for example, LNG, which has greatly expanded, of course, in the years since Fukushima, with the shutdown of most of the nuclear reactors in the country, which were providing a significant percentage of Japan's energy. So we saw a spike in imports of liquefied natural gas in the last few years. As to them, who are the main suppliers? That's an interesting question. I don't know what countries make up what percentage of the LNG market here and where they're importing from specifically. But I did see this headline about Japan to offer $10 billion plan for Asian LNG infrastructure, which I don't know the details of this, but it sounds to me like perhaps Japan is looking with India as a partner, interestingly enough, at increasing LNG infrastructure in Asia, which, by the way, I think would probably benefit Japan and Japan's access, ongoing access to those supplies. So I think there's some interesting moves being made in the energy markets here in Asia that may portend a change that's coming overall in energy infrastructure and markets generally globally, especially in this era where the U.S. is now no longer a oil-dependent importer, or at least not the major one. China has long since surpassed it as the major importer. So there's definitely a change in global energy markets, and we're seeing that reflected, of course, in the big news of the last month, which was Reuters reporting that, Saudi Aramco, they're talking they're going to do an IPO next year somewhere. They haven't decided where they're going to list, and they're going to offer a 5% stake valued at $100 billion in Saudi Aramco. Well, Reuters is reporting that, did you know, Chinese state-owned oil companies PetroChina and Sinopec have apparently formally offered Saudi Aramco to outright buy that 5% stake directly. Don't list it. Don't put it out on the market. We'll just buy it from you. And Saudi Arabia is at least mulling that over right now, especially with the chaos that's going on right now and the old sink in oil prices. Maybe the $2 trillion valuation on Saudi Aramco is overvalued. Maybe they're not going to make that $100 billion IPO. So maybe they should just sell it outright to China. What an incredible change in energy markets that would portend, because, again, I think the shifting of Saudi Arabia over to the Chinese umbrella and away from the U.S. umbrella is potentially the story of the 21st century.
Might be, because the Saudis laid the foundation for the petrodollar by agreeing to sell their crude oil only for U.S. dollars in 1971, and the dollar has been dominant in the world for 40 years because of that one act. And if they change their mind and say, well, it's been nice talking to you, but we're now going to work with the yuan instead of the dollar, or even the yuan as well as the dollar, what does that do to the value of the dollar? What's it do to the United States economy, Western economy? Do you have any idea of what might happen?
Well, I think you're exactly right in the picture you paint there, in the fact that for the last 4.5 decades, since the dollar was taken off the gold standard and Bretton Woods was formally ended by Nixon, it has been backed up primarily as the petrodollar. It's Saudi agreeing to denominate their oil sales in U.S. dollars, accept U.S. dollars for oil, and then filter those U.S. dollars back through the U.S. banking system in the form of treasury purchases. That has been the backbone of the world monetary order. And because of that, of course, OPEC generally and all other nations basically price their oil in dollars. And so everyone has to hold dollars. Everyone needs dollar reserves. Everyone wants dollars. Everyone will buy as much U.S. debt as needed in order to have their stake in that. And that has been the backbone, as you say, of the world economy for the last four and a half decades. That if that changes, and as you say, it doesn't have to be an all at once or all out change. Okay, now we're going to denominate in yuan. It could be, well, now we'll sell to China directly for yuan or gold or whatever it is they agreement they come to. That again, that could be a significant change, even if it's just a chipping away overall in terms of the dollar strength. It would be a significant chip and perhaps part of the first domino to fall, as it were.
What do you think about the plan China has announced where they are going to tie the yuan to petroleum products, try to, and in that regard, the yuan will emulate the petrodollar, will have the petro-yuan, but they're also going to back it up, at least indirectly, with physical gold. We are tying the yuan to petrodollars, excuse me, we're tying the yuan to crude oil and to gold in a single kind of currency. Is this a good idea, bad idea, a real idea? And what are the consequences going to be if this actually takes place?
Yeah, well, good and bad depend on where you're sitting, ultimately. And if you're sitting in Beijing, I'm sure it seems like a very good idea. If you're in Washington, maybe not so much. So there is definitely, whatever you say about it, it is a significant event. And I think will be seen as an increasingly significant event as this idea picks up steam. For those who don't know, yes, it was announced back in September that this newly created Shanghai International Energy Exchange was going to be pricing yuan-denominated oil contracts, i.e. they were going to be offering oil futures in yuan directly, not dollars, in yuan. So, and as you say, tie that to the Shanghai Gold Exchange, which opened up last year, where you could directly trade yuan for gold, and you have this interesting circular system where you can trade between countries. China can buy oil for yuan, and that country, that recipient country, can go and take those yuan and exchange them for gold. It's a very interesting situation that's emerging, and as you say, potentially an entirely new monetary paradigm. It really can't be stressed how important these moves could be, depending, of course, how they play out, or how they're even allowed to play out, because as we've seen time and time and time and time again throughout history, and certainly even recent history, if we look at Libya, every time someone tries to or even threatens to, hey, why don't I price this oil in something else? Mm-hmm. Or, hey, why don't I create a gold-backed dinar currency for Africa? Bad things tend to happen to those countries. Mm-hmm. Saw it in Iraq, saw it in Libya. See it in China, question mark?
Can we make bad things happen in China? Is it safe? Is it even possible?
Is it too big a target to attack? Well, the only question is, how would you go about attacking? Would it be a full-on military adventure like in Libya? No, it certainly couldn't be that kind of NATO love bombing. That obviously wouldn't work against China. So the only question, I think, is how can this be undermined, or it may be co-opted? And as we've talked about before, what China is ultimately in this for is a better seat at the mahogany table. They have openly advocated for the IMF to be the arbiter of the new form of the monetary paradigm, presumably under the special drawing rights that the IMF issues, but maybe some other system. But China has openly said the IMF should be in charge of this, and China has openly invested a lot of money in the IMF recently. So it is interesting to see whether perhaps this will just be diverted into that sort of system, which ultimately comes under the control of the same people who control Washington, D.C. The U.S. as a nation-state entity may lose out, but the globalists who are in charge of Washington and structure the banking structures generally probably will not lose their ultimate place at the top of that power pyramid.
And when we look at what China is trying to do with this new currency proposal and monetary system they're proposing, should this be viewed as an attack on the dollar, or should it be reviewed or viewed as a way to avoid U.S. sanctions that have been imposed on China to some degree, and especially Russia, by means of the SWIFT system? If you're using dollars, you are vulnerable to government control by the United States government. Are they trying to avoid sanctions? Are they trying to attack? I'm sure the answer is both, but what do you think is predominant?
Well, it has to be seen as a defensive strategy, and we have to see that in the context of what happened to Iran back when those sanctions were being heavily slapped on Iran during the freak out about the non-existent nuclear program 5 or 6 years ago, and we started to see all these incredibly strict sanctions being slapped on Iran, including the delisting from the SWIFT network, which says, honest to goodness, we're not a political entity and no politicians hold any sway over us. But then the U.S. comes calling and says, can you delist Iran? And they're like, okay, sir, how high, sir? So we know that it is used as a weapon, and that was obviously quite an alarming thing for people like China and Russia and other countries that find themselves in the U.S. State Department's crosshairs. So they do things like attempt to kind of partially create alternative, quote-unquote, SWIFT networks and things like that, which we've seen in recent years from China, that ultimately sign agreements to use the SWIFT network as the actual network that transmits their information. So what kind of alternative is it? But anyway, we see this kind of language, and we have to understand that things like this, this idea of creating a total bilateral exchange in local currencies has to be seen as a way of saying, look, we're going to go around your financial institutions to every extent possible so that you cannot do these sanctions against us and we can directly transact with other people. I think it has to be seen in that context. And that's a perfectly predictable result of the types of ways that the U.S. has been throwing its weight around internationally in the last several years, including with those sanctions against Iran. And the encirclement of Russia and China militarily and economically and otherwise, again, perfectly predictable that they will start creating these alternative structures, quote unquote, and that they will run into each other's arms. So much so that I think that is demonstrably part of the plan. That clearly has to be part of the plan, because I think the ultimate plan is, how do we create a global structure? It's only through the creation of these regional groupings, and how do we bolster some sort of countervailing power to the unquestioned unipolar world superpower of the U.S.? We have to drive people like China and Russia into each other's arms.
I think what we're seeing, you talk about the United States throwing its weight around. It's certainly done that. It's undoubtedly antagonized people around the world who are probably pretty much fed up. They've gone along with the program. They've probably had enough of it. If there's a chance to knock that dollar down, I think they'll be happy. They will cheer if it happens. We're going to have to let it go at that. Thanks very much for being on the program, James. Always interesting, informative, and fun talking to you. Look forward to talking to you again in 4 weeks. We're out of time, folks. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow. Melody and I will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, and Todd, the producer, and James Corbett. Good night.
A single penny left for me.
That's too bad. In my